Committee on General Government to order. Have to think about where we are. Let's see. We have a number of things on our agenda today, and they all are work sessions. I think that we probably can. I think we could go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2148. Members, you have before you a set of Dash 2 amendments for this bill. They were passed out yesterday afternoon, and I hope you've all had the opportunity to look at them. Basically, what the Dash 2s will do, well, Patrick, maybe you'd like to lead us through what the Dash 2s will do.
Can you lead us through what
the Dash 2s will do?
Okay, let me lead us through what the Dash 2s will do then. The Dash 2s are a rewrite of the bill, and what it will do is the this is a budget reform bill, and as it always has been. In Section 2, it would require the governor's budget to indicate how additional funding, if necessary, might be achieved in the present biennium and in the two future bienniums. Section 3 requires the governor's budget message to include an amount in reserve of funds available, funding increase, any funding increases proposed, and an explanation of the methodology used to determine them, and it also requires an unobligated amount of 5% be placed in reserve to avoid cash flow interruptions and for unanticipated non-recurring expenditures. Section 4 requires reports on capital construction projects of over $20 million to be done at least once every 2 years. And the Section 5 directs the governor to require agencies to integrate performance measures for operating efficiencies, effectiveness, citizen satisfaction, and so on, and establishes a budget control system within DAS, Department of Administrative Services. Section 6 establishes a revenue management policy for the state. Section 7 requires the legislature to develop a plan for state agencies to use in case of budget shortfalls. Section 8 requires a legislatively adopted budget to leave an unobligated amount of 5%, again, to avoid cash flow interruptions. And then Section 9 allows for the, at the end of the biennium, allow state agencies to keep 50% of their leftover funding that they save through efficiencies and use them for some things they determine, such as building maintenance, technological enhancements and that sort of thing. And then the remaining 50% would go to the e-board for them to allocate to the same agency. And then Section 11 deals with existing language definitions, and Section 12 directs Joint Ways and Means Committee to examine budgets to evaluate whether to reduce, reorganize, or eliminate the agency and examine whether a private entity could or should perform the agency's functions. So that gives you, committee, a very quick run, kind of a down and dirty rundown of the amendments. I have worked with DAS, Department of Administrative Services, on these amendments, and have also worked with the Legislative Fiscal Office on these amendments. And I'm looking to see, there's Cindy back there. Cindy, can you come up for a moment, please? This is Cindy Beck from Department of Administrative Services. And we had, at first, we had some technical problems with sections 9, what are now sections 9 and 10, but I think those have been pretty well addressed in terms of the mechanics of those dollars going back to the agencies and that sort of thing. And also, I've had conversations with the governor's office, and they seem to be okay with it. But did you have anything that you wanted or needed to add to put on the record? Or
Cindy Becker, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Department of Administrative Services. We have been working with Representative Kummel to make this bill something that makes sense and is workable and doable, and I think that that's been accomplished, so we're fine.
Okay, great. All right. Does anybody have any questions for Representative Brzezinski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Cindy, I think just for the record, my understanding is that you're saying DAS is comfortable with the bill as it is with the DASH 2s?
Correct.
And the governor's office is basically, I guess, directed your agency to work with the chair and coming up with this finished product?
Well, I don't know that I would say the governor's office has directed that.
Asked you to assist?
Well, we've been working with representative, and I don't. I guess I wouldn't even go so far as to say we don't run all of these bills. I mean, every single one through the governor's office.
Okay.
And so we've been working, you know, within our understanding of where the governor's office would want to be on this, and in terms of what can be done.
Thank you. This is for the record. Appreciate it.
Okay. Any other questions for Cindy? Okay, Cindy, thank you very much. Appreciate it. So, with that, does anybody have any questions about it? With that, the chair would move the DASH 2 amendments into House Bill 2148. Are there any comments, discussion, any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I've moved House Bill 2148 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2148 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any questions? The one question that has come up is that is whether or not there's a fiscal, and it's because of the 5% unobligated amount. I have spoken with the co-chair on the House side, and he's indicated that as long as the fiscal, there seems to be an indeterminate at this point fiscal, that he sees no reason for this bill to not go ahead and go to the floor. So I appreciate Representative Przanski's motion, and with that, if there's not any other discussion, you want to call the roll, please, Gina?
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. House Bill 2148. Having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed on the floor with a due pass recommendation. And if the committee doesn't have an objection, the chair will carry.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
It'd be better explaining it than any of us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that confidence. I appreciate it. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2148. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2246. Patrick, can you bring us up to date on this one?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
House Bill 2246, we heard way back in January 28th. The bill allows the Department of Housing and Community Services to charge fees for providing persons with intellectual property acquired or developed by the department. It appropriates monies from said fees to the department. We have since that meeting, we have received a statement of minimal fiscal impact on the bill. We also have the DASH 1 amendments, which I believe we have Sue Wilson here will be coming up to explain. Those amendments also have minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Great. Sue, do you want to come on up? And is Phil here also? Okay. Could you just go ahead and you were going to address the DASH 1 amendments, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Would you go ahead and do that, please?
Okay. Chair Crummell and the representatives, thank you for providing this opportunity to be here. My name is Susan Wilson, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. I'm a member of that organization, as well as the executive director of the Housing Authority of Washington County. And just a little background, our agency serves over 10,000 low-income people in Washington County. And like most housing authorities throughout the state, our client population are generally elderly, they're disabled, they're single head of households with incomes at or below 30% of the median income. And in Washington County, as an example, our waiting list is over 6,000 families. So without question, there's a tremendous need for affordable housing everywhere in the state, and providing that housing is often very, very challenging, and particularly in our current economic climate. To meet this challenge, housing authorities have understood, and this has been for some time, that the necessity of adopting a more entrepreneurial approach to the financing and delivery of housing services. And that means less reliance on federal dollars and a greater reliance on our own ingenuity. And, for example, in Washington County, we were the first organization in the state of Oregon to finance housing with what is called a master indenture used in conjunction with tax-exempt bonds issued by the authority. This allowed us to purchase existing affordable properties that were and preserve them while reducing our costs by and taxpayers by thousands of dollars. Another example is the development of a unique program to detail and estimate development, operation, and cash flow for housing acquisitions and new construction. Or the unique tracking system for analyzing housing management costs. Future projects might include special studies to identify changes in population characteristics and trends to better identify and track and pinpoint our services. These examples, and I understand they're very, very technical, but they have significant impact on our ability to deliver, and they are and they save taxpayers' dollars, and they are transferable to other localities and private concerns. However, our ability to do these kinds of things, to explore these new frontiers, in many cases requires your permission in the form of HB 2246, and particularly Amendment-1. This bill will allow us to create and pay for innovative approaches that will create greater efficiencies, and they already have, reduce public costs, and better serve the low-income people of the state of Oregon. And on behalf of all housing authorities in the state of Oregon, we urge you to vote affirmatively on HB 2246 and particularly Amendment-1. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Susan?
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Would you pass that down, please? So, and you'll remember, committee, that this did come to us from the Oregon Housing Department. With that, are there any questions about the Dash 1 amendments by any chance?
I have a comment once we get it on the board.
Okay. All right. Representative Vodkin, would you like to move the Dash 1 amendments?
Thank you. I'd move the Dash 1 amendments be included in the original bill.
Thank you. Representative Vodkin moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2246 to amend the bill. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I guess want to put on the record, it's pretty interesting when I was looking at the Dash 1s, it talks about intellectual property and persons having the meanings that are given under Section 1 of this Act, and of course it gives you the definitions there. But I just went ahead and pulled the word and phrases to see how many definitions we have per person, and it looks like we have over 100 different definitions per person. So we'll just add one more there.
Okay.
It's amazing. I mean, it feels
kind of like Dalmatians.
Yeah. Persons for each definition.
Thank you for pointing that out, Representative.
I go back that. Here.
Okay. The motion is to is there any further discussion about the Dash 1 amendments, Representative Kitts?
I'd just like to thank Representative Zanski for that most excellent point for the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. With that, then, are there any objections to the Dash 1 amendments being included in the bill? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Vavakian?
I'd move that House Bill 2246 with the Dash 1 amendments be moved to the floor with due pass recommendation, and since there was no fiscal impact, that any referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you. Representative Avakian moves House Bill 2246 to the floor with a due pass as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, Jeannie, you want to call the roll, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2246, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Avakian, would you like to carry this?
Be happy to. Thank you, Mr.
Great.
Chair.
Thank you. Representative Avakian will be the carrier. Thank you very much. Moving on, then, we'll close the public hearing. The work session on House Bill 2246. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2410. And I would add, Patrick, would you give us a little rundown on this bill, please?
I'd be glad to. House Bill 2410 authorizes the Office of Emergency Management to establish a program for credentialing health care professionals for voluntary service during emergencies. It provides a declaration of emergency by the governor. Under that, a credentialed health care professional provides services could be considered an agent of Oregon Department of Administrative Services. Specifies a department to be assessed for insurance and other items. We heard this bill first on February 20th. We have before us the Dash 5 amendments, which were the product of a work group led by Dr. Grant Higginson, who will probably be able to give us an explanation of those amendments.
That would be most excellent. Grant, you want to come on up? And also, Bruce, you want to come up with him? And Scott, did you want to come up also, please? I'm going to just kind of have you go ahead and come up as a panel. Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Przanski.
I was wanting clarification. We do have proposed revisions to House Bill 2410. That's two and a half pages. I'm wondering if this goes with the Dash 5s or if this out of date.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, that is now out of date. When we came in the first time, that was the suggested language that we replaced with the original bill. Since that, it's been modified several times, and what we're now working off is the Dash 5 amendments.
Back in the file, then.
So that goes back in the file, yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services. And as Patrick was mentioning, this bill actually and the amendments reflect what we were said on February 20th is really doing three things. The first thing we're trying to do is to create a registry of healthcare professionals so that if we ever needed to deploy a small cadre of healthcare professionals to do some specific things for us, like to set up a mobile hospital, to do mass vaccination clinics, that we would have that resource available and they would be covered as agents of the state. The second piece is in the case of a major disaster, we would want to have the ability for health care facilities and for state designated emergency centers to be able to utilize volunteer health care professionals and again have those professionals covered as agents of the state for liability purposes. And then in addition to that, we wanted to make sure that those hospitals that are acting as emergency facilities and are providing services without compensation, that they too could be covered as agents of the state and have some liability coverage. And so that's what the dash that these amendments are supposed to do. And do you want to walk through the bill?
If you could can you briefly walk through? I know it's right. I know it's kind of a section. Maybe you can just kind of walk us through section by section as far as what it does.
Right. Section 1 simply puts this in ORS Chapter 401, which is the emergency declaration, emergency management part of Oregon law. Section 2 just creates a couple of definitions, healthcare facilities and healthcare providers. We used to have more definitions, but it was decided since they're really explained in the heart of the bill that was not needed. Section 3 is setting up the registration system, where it's saying that we as the department can set up the system. We may require additional training. As we've discussed with professional organizations, that training would not be professional training. That training would be how you act in the case of an emergency. And then it specifies that we would have a card that has a number of pieces of information on the card. In Section 3, Sub 4, there's a statement that the Department of Human Services shall support and provide assistance to the Office of Emergency Management. This was simply put in so that it was clear why Department of Human Services is in OEM statute. Section 4 then talks about the department when there has been a declared emergency or crisis, that the department then can designate either all or part of a health care facility as an emergency center, or we can set up additional emergency centers if those were needed. So if what we needed to do was set up a mass vaccination clinic and thought that a gymnasium was the best place to do that, that gives us the authority to do that and spells out what kind of things we have the ability to provide in those emergency centers. It then goes on to say in sub 3 of section 4 that the emergency health care center must have an emergency operations plan and a credentialing plan, and that those must comply with rules that will be developed by the department. And the issue here is one really with risk management, that that DAS has been saying, Department of Administrative Services has been saying, you know, we're willing to provide some additional risk to the state in the case of an emergency or a crisis, but it's also important to put some kind of limits around that as well. So we need to make sure that whoever is running the facility or the healthcare center is following an emergency operation plan, which would include emergency credentialing provisions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
Just to make sure we got this on the record, it's my understanding, or I guess my belief, is that when this emergency is declared, a center is identified, that whoever is going to be in control of that will actually have the credentialing plan that will be brought in to that center. The center itself, or the geographic area, we're not asking them to have a credentialing plan for something that may never happen with their center or their facility, I should say.
Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski, if I'm understanding this correctly, in the case of a hospital, we would simply look at their existing plans that they have for an emergency operations plan and a credentialing plan, say, yes, that is fine. If they were ever designated during a crisis or an emergency as a emergency center, they simply would follow those plans. In the case of the centers that we on the public health side would be setting up, we need to, in our rulemaking process and then after that, actually think through some of the scenarios that are possible. You know, a mass vaccination clinic, a mass disaster, we would want to set up a triage and transport center. And for those different scenarios, we need to come up with then the emergency operations plan and the credentialing plan, so that when we say, Lane County Health Department, we need you to set up that mass vaccination clinic, here's a template to use for the administrator who's going to be running that center.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 6, then goes into how emergency health care providers or volunteers are able to provide the services. And This section is really trying to say that it is the hospitals, the subsection 2, it's the hospital and healthcare facility that is responsible for determining what is the role of the individuals that come in to provide those services. One of the issues that we had during the work group discussions was a concern that the state was being too controlling or could be too restrictive on what professionals could do, and that really needs to be up to the healthcare facility or the emergency center to decide how to best utilize those volunteers, because they're the ones that are actually going to be on site dealing with that. Section 7 is where it goes into that healthcare emergency healthcare providers or volunteers that are providing services without compensation will be covered as agents of the state. Sub 2 in Section 7 gives that same coverage to healthcare facilities as well. Subsection 3 says that in addition to a crisis, if we are sponsoring training for registered emergency health care providers, that they would be covered under the State Tort Claims Act as well. And then 4, again, simply spells out that in order for people to be covered, for people and for facilities and centers to be covered, they need to be following the plan. Okay. They simply can't have a plan in place and disregard that plan if they're going to be covered under State Tort Claims Act.
You mean they got to do what
they said they were going to do. Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct. So So that's the basis of the bill, and this was a product after the last work session, after the last public hearing, you asked that we pull a work group together to work on this, and we actually had a broad-based group work on it. We had a number of meetings, a number of versions of the bill has come out, and as you can see, this is the -5 amendments. We thought that we were totally fine with all the language, and we're coming to you today to ask for it to be passed, but that's not quite the case. The hospitals still have concerns, and Bruce will talk more about that, but as I understand it, there was a concern that there might be some additional requirements put on them in the way of emergency operation plan and credentialing plans. That's not the intent. They should all have that for licensure anyway, and those would be the plans that we would be saying, yes, these are fine. I think there's also been some concern that the state might be too controlling and restrictive, and again, that is not the intent, although we do, as I said, have to have some limits around what we're going to take risk at in order for DAS to be happy. I believe that everyone conceptually agrees that we want to get this through and that we are pretty close, and so the plan would be to ask you, Mr. Chair, if we could have another couple of days to try to tweak these amendments and bring them back for a work session on Thursday. And my understanding is that we all agree that if we can't come to final agreement, that we would accept moving this out on Thursday and fixing it on the Senate side.
Okay. Bruce, you want to go ahead and address what the concerns might be? And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. First of all, let me say that we support the concept behind the bill, and hospitals are prepared in the event of an emergency to fulfill the role that their communities expect them to fulfill of being a care center that will be responsive to their needs. We also support Dr. Higginson's characterization of what he intends to do and what his office would intend to do in the event that there were an emergency or a crisis that would trigger this kind of a law's taking effect. Let me just try to pinpoint 2 specific issues that we have with the -5 amendments that we think can be resolved readily. First of all, and both of these issues occur in Section 5. They may not be limited to Section 5, but I think by pointing the committee to Section 5, I can at least explain what our concerns are. First of all, on page 2, line 30 of the -5 amendments, it says, declaring that there is an impending or existing public health crisis, continuing on page 3. And so this law intends to take effect when there's an emergency or an impending public health crisis. That is language that is intended to be defined in House Bill 2251, which is in a separate committee and is sort of companion legislation. But the two bills aren't necessarily tied together. And so in the event that 2410 should pass without 2251, we will have language about an impending public health crisis that is not defined in the way that health services would like to define it. So we think that those circumstances need to be specifically described in statute so that everybody's clear about what authority can be exercised in the event of an emergency or crisis.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
So, Bruce, are we just going to put that definition into this just to make certain if the other one doesn't go through, you have that understanding, or we have that understanding as to what it is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, that would be one approach, is to define that specifically and then to have a conflict amendment, for example, depending on which one passes last, to make sure that there's no inconsistency between the two.
Okay.
The second issue involves Section 5, Subsection 2. That's on page 3, lines 7 through 10. And it says that any emergency health care provider that's registered under this act or other health care provider may volunteer to perform health care services described in the Act. And those are evaluation, referral, provision of health care services, preparation of patients for transportation. That those services may be performed at any emergency health care center or health care facility. And our concern here is that in the event of an emergency or crisis, we need to make clear who's in charge of the facility, particularly in a hospital. And it is our view that the hospital should retain control over the facility and act pursuant to its emergency services plan. I think that's what Dr. Higginson expressed their view to be as well. But the concern is that subsection 5 sub 2 gives authority for any provider to go into any hospital and exercise authority. And we just need to make sure that that language doesn't extend authority beyond the emergency and beyond the scope of the training of that healthcare professional. To make clear when the liability immunity takes effect and who's responsible, who's accountable for actions that would take place in a hospital or in another emergency services facility. Those, I believe, sort of focus the concerns that we have still with the draft. We are in support of the concept and believe that we can work this language to line up with the concept in the near future.
So, Bruce, you think that the language in starting on page 3, line 7, and going into line 8 and 9 is not specific enough? Is that part of the concern there?
It's not specific enough, and in fact, as I read it, I'm not sure that it's even necessary. It may be redundant with other provisions, and it may be possible to eliminate it altogether, because I think there is other authority that says that healthcare providers who are registered under the Act may be able to perform the services that they're qualified to do.
Okay. Representative Brzezinski.
Bruce, could you give us that number of that other bill that you're saying that's...
Yes, House Bill 2251.
Thank you.
Which is a bill relating to the state of impending health, public health crisis.
Right.
So it's squarely on that issue.
One other question, if I could.
Go ahead, Representative.
Regarding that subsection 2, I understand the intent and goal is to have the hospital maintain control, but in who knows what type of emergency it may be, wouldn't the governor be able to actually, under some type of almost like martial law, take over that facility if the need should rise to that level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, the governor probably has that authority with or without this bill becoming law. And
just
we're trying to make sure that we at least express as clearly as possible relative responsibilities and who's accountable for those services.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might add to that,
yes.
on the subsection 2 that Bruce Bishop was bringing up, it talks about the emergency health care providers or volunteers can present to any health care facility or emergency health care center. It's that next section, section 6, that was attempting to say that it really is the hospital that is in charge, that those health care providers and volunteers must provide those services in accordance with the emergency operations plan and credentialing plan adopted by the health care center or facility. And then sub 2 goes on to say, and it's really the hospital or health care facility that is defining the scope of practice.
Okay. So, are you planning to try to do the amendments as as another complete rewrite, or do you think you'll do them as a secondary amendment to these? I'm just wondering about being able to get which way is going to be better to get it through Legislative Council the quickest.
And Mr. Chair, I think it'll depend on how many changes we actually think that we're going to need.
Okay. Scott, did you want to make a comment about this?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, for the record, Scott Gallen with the Oregon Medical Association. Again, conceptually, we agree that this legislation is an important bill. It does need clarification. I think, again, just to remind the committee to state what this bill is and what it isn't. The committee is correct in that the governor has constitutional authority to take over the control of any facility, a bank, a sewage system, anything under a state of emergency. During one of the early special sessions last year, the legislature adopted an interstate compact that essentially provides the governor and the state the authority in a, an emergency circumstance to ask other states to provide emergency personnel, health care providers, or others, and they are afforded protection under the State Tort Claims Act, regardless of whether or not those individuals are paid by the state for their services, for example, a fire emergency or whatever. This bill's limitations are, in fact, that professional or physicians and other health care providers are afforded state tort claims protection if they volunteer their services under the provisions of the bill and under the authority of the governor and the health division and others who would implement it. So you should realize that the administration and others have decided for varying reasons that if someone is employed in these facilities or otherwise, they would not be afforded protection of the State Tort Claims Act merely because they are being paid, say, as a nurse or otherwise, but are faced with this sort of circumstance. So you should, you know, be clear that there is a differentiation for some individuals, state employees and others, versus those that we're going to depend on in what could be a horrendous circumstance if there were a bioterrorism attack or other circumstance where clearly there would be a great deal of chaos and confusion in those circumstances. But overall, while no legislation is perfect, and this bill certainly fits that description, the association supports it in concept. We believe in the long run that it should, in fact, be broader. We think this should move forward and will help clarify the sections that have been discussed so far.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions for either one of these gentlemen? Thank you very much. Ken, did you want to come up and say anything, or they've pretty well covered it all? Okay. What I'm going to do then, I do have one question for the three of you, and that is, if perchance we were not able to get the amendments back from Legislative Council by Thursday, and understanding our need to move this on, would you be okay with us adopting the dash fives and sending the bill out, understanding that it's going to be that the issues that you bring up, Bruce, would be addressed on the Senate side?
Mr. Chair, for the Hospital Association, we would be, but we have a high level of confidence in our ability to identify what the changes should be, and Legislative Council is translating them into appropriate statutory language.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay. With that, then, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2410, and we will put it back on the agenda for Thursday, April 17th. Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2961, and Patrick, you want to give us an update on this?
Sure, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2961, we have not heard before. We had a TAP hearing on that bill. The bill authorizes specified districts and authorities to provide sanitary sewer service to lots, parcels, or tracts that are outside of an urban growth boundary, but within the boundary of the district or authority on as of January 1st, 2003. I believe we have Burton Wiest in the audience. Will
yes, we do.
Explain the bill.
Burton, you want to come on up and explain the bill for us, please? And there are no amendments, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'm Burton Wiest. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. What I would like to do with the chair as a permission is just briefly explain what the bill does and what it's about. And then there are some folks here from Medford and from Nehalem who are affected by this bill that, if the committee's willing, have some comments for the committee, can discuss why the bill is necessary.
As long as they're brief, yes.
They came from a long way, very brief.
We'll hear them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what this bill does is, this bill deals with an anomaly, and it only applies in a few isolated areas of the state. It deals with the situation of where an urban growth boundary was drawn, but did not include all the territory within a sanitary district. So it's a situation where we have in the state, in parts of the state, we have a situation where people are taxpayers and within a sanitary district, but they are outside an urban growth boundary, and because of the requirements of Goal 11, they cannot connect, even though there may be, and in many cases are, sewer lines in front of their homes or in front of their businesses. And it's a result of the way Goal 11 works. We met with the commission some time ago and tried to work out an agreement on this, and we came out with another process that involved DEQ. And the result of that process was that I don't think more than one or two hookups were approved under that process. So this session we have come back with a bill. As I say, the bill is very narrow, and what the first part of the bill talks about is that, oh, excuse me, I'm asleep here. I have written testimony.
Well, I do it so rarely.
You seem to be doing fine, though.
Yeah, well,
without us reading without behind you.
What the bill says is that on district boundaries as of January 1st, if you are inside a district, currently inside a district, but outside the UGB, you are eligible to get hooked up with conditions. And the conditions are that the expansion of the urban growth boundary to include this property, the existence of sewer cannot be used as a reason for expanding the urban growth boundary in that area, that you cannot use an exception based on the existence of the sewer, nor can you change the zoning that currently exists on that property. So the idea here is to ensure that no additional development other than that already authorized in that area for development can occur, but if you're within that district, you can hook up. And that's essentially what the bill does. And the folks here will explain the kind of issues they come across when they get into this kind of anomaly situation of being outside the boundary but inside a district for, in some cases, for 30 or 40 years inside a district, and have a situation where their neighbors are hooked up to the sewer, but because the boundary was drawn later, they can't hook up to the sewer, even though it's on each side of them. So that, Mr. Chair, that's what the bill does, and if I may, we could have the folks come up and very quickly explain the kind of situations they deal with.
That would be good. Let me see. We have Representative Worth and Representative Przanski have questions for you, Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Here is what I see. I see the potential existing for running undersized infrastructure out there, and therefore precluding or defining how much growth can then take place if the urban growth boundary is extended in that area.
Chair Crummell, Representative Worth, that's an issue now, because right now under the current LCDC rules, we are not allowed, any city or district is not allowed to run oversized lines to the edge of the urban growth boundary. We have to assume that the growth boundary is the limit of growth. And so today, whether we're inside or outside the boundary, we're limited on the pipe sizes that we can extend.
Follow up. Okay, I'm not saying oversized. You know, we base what size infrastructure we run out to these areas based upon our population forecast. And in Corvallis, in fact, there's a number of times where groups have tried to underestimate the population so as to run out undersized infrastructure, and therefore we preclude how, you know, we can't maximize the land at that point when we are ready to urbanize. And so what I'm saying is, you know, based upon, you're going to run out infrastructure to these folks based upon one or two, you know, structures per parcel or whatever, which is going to be way undersized come the time when we fully grow out or, you know, expand that UGB. So if it's already a problem within the UGB, why then make it even a bigger problem outside the UGB when nothing's slated for growth at that point?
Representative Crummell, Representative Wirth, on the technical side of it, I'll let people that are smarter about sewers than I am explain that. On the political side, one reason the bill is written the way it is we're trying very hard to assure LCDC and agriculture and other groups that this is not a bill that's going to lead to subdivisions out on farmland. So that's one reason we put the very strong restrictions in here on this bill and limit it to those existing people only. Your comment is absolutely correct, but it was our view that in order to ensure we're not going to prematurely develop farmland, that we needed these restrictions in the bill.
Okay. Representative Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Burton, a couple of questions. Do you know how many properties we're talking about statewide that would be impacted by this?
Chair Crummell, Representative Przanski, we actually did a survey. We sent out to the sanitary districts. There's about, and I'm going to apologize, I managed to leave the survey over in my office, but my recollection is there's about 40 sanitary districts in the state. There were about 16 of them that had property outside of that fit the category of this bill, and almost all of them were very small areas with one exception, and that is Bear Creek Valley Sanitary Authority, and they're here today to talk about their situation. The direct answer to question, I cannot tell you that, because the way the bill is written, it would allow not only an existing person, but if it was legal today to build a house on a parcel, it would allow that parcel to develop also.
Right.
So I don't have an exact number. Our estimate based on the survey is we're not talking about a very large, with the exception of Bear Creek Valley, we're not talking about a very large number of hookups.
Okay. A couple of follow-ups. And I appreciate, Burton, the candidness as to the potential build-outs for those lots or whatever. Do we even know how many lots are, if those areas are even able to be subdivided into smaller parcels, not knowing what type of geographic areas we're talking about?
Chair Crummell, Representative Przanski, it's almost impossible to go back in each area and try to determine that. In our survey, we just asked the districts to estimate how many lots they thought could be served under this bill at some point in the future. One of the things you find is that the sewer lines aren't even necessarily anywhere near some of the lots, even though they're in the district. So it's hard to estimate how many they are. We had most districts that responded to us had numbers in the 100, less than 100, and then that was over an extended period of time.
One last question.
Follow-up, yes.
Regarding the situation that these different homeowners or property owners have found themselves in, is there not a process at the local level for them to go back and either have the boundaries readjusted or drawn to accommodate those issues instead of having state legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, there is a process in the statute called the exceptions process. I would suggest you expanding an urban growth boundary to get sewer is not a reasonable thing, and I think all sides, all people in the process would agree that's a very difficult thing to do in this state. However, the process is called a goal exception. It can be used, but there's going to be testimony regarding a fire station, which we can indicate. Using the exception process is not just a matter of filing paperwork and going through a hearing. It requires not only going through the local process, adopting findings, going through the planning commission, hiring consultants. It also requires state approval, and that process takes a considerable amount of time and a considerable amount of money. Our view was is that this is kind of an anomaly. It's not really a land use planning issue. It's kind of an anomaly we find ourselves in, and that this solution was better than hundreds of property owners having to go through the exception process to get sewer.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
If I may, if I could just
yes, go ahead.
Be quick, and if I could just introduce Chuck Root from Bear Creek Valley Sanitary Authority, and he can introduce the other folks real quick.
Great. Thanks, Bert.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to General Government.
Thank you very much. Shirley, why don't you go ahead and start?
Good morning.
Chair Crummell, members of the committee. My name is Shirley Kalkoven. I'm a board member of the Nehalem Bay Wastewater Agency, which is a small sanitary district that serves three incorporated cities and another community around the Nehalem Bay and on the Pacific Ocean. I'm also a member of the Nehalem City Council, and I chair the League of Cities Water Committee, and we do deal with sewer issues sometimes. I wanted to just tell you of a couple of examples that have been in our district for a number of years. In 1994, we built a sewer down McDonnell Road. This road parallels the Nehalem River on one side. Our line was constructed on the other side away from the river. We put two pump stations on adjacent property. And the owner of that property has a house right there on McDonnell Road, and you know the sewer goes in front of his house, but we couldn't hook him up to the sewer because he is outside of the urban growth boundary line by a few feet. We have another example half a mile away, the Esplin property, where his property straddles Highway 53 and Highway 101 along the Nehalem River. And, in fact, our high-pressure line that goes to the city of Wheeler crosses his property on an easement, but we can't hook his house up because he, again, is outside of the urban growth boundary. Our little grocery store on the Nehalem River, the Moeller Co-op, does have a line that's been built to connect to our system, and some houses near it on Old Wheeler Moeller Road cannot be hooked up because, again, they're outside of the UGB. These are existing homes, probably 10 in all. It would make a lot of sense to connect them to our system and get rid of the septic systems. As probably you know, the Nehalem River is pretty famous for its salmon runs, and in fact, the governor's recent announcement of 17 anchor habitats, five of them are in the lower Nehalem River watershed. Mm-hmm. And those salmon swim right by the river with these properties, and it would make a lot of sense to be able to get rid of those septic systems. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Crummell and members of the committee, my name is Chuck Root. I'm the manager of Bear Creek Valley Sanitary Authority. We provide sewer service to approximately 40,000 people in Jackson County, including the cities of Talent, Central Point, and Eagle Point. Also with me today is Walter Wassum, our board chairman, and Keith Grant, vice chairman, is in the audience behind me. And Mr. Wassum would like to say a few words about the beginnings of our district.
Okay.
Chairman and committee, in the early 60s, when I first moved to Medford, I ended
Could
up being on
the name for the record, please.
Willie Wassum, Walter Wassum.
Thank you.
Moved to Medford and ended up in the Chamber of Commerce. And right after that, we had a big flood out of Bear Creek. And the stuff you could have seen on our park and in the shopping center would have scared you to even walk close. So this started the committee to decide and work on building a system, some way of how to we could the Chamber of Commerce. And we spent hours and hours and hours, and out of this, Bear Creek Valley Sanitary was started and developed into what it is today. And as chairman, I am proud to be part of it and be taking care of it, making sure that we continue on serving the people that need it and doing things for the valley to make it better for us.
Thank you.
Yes. There's a few people that could not be here today, but I've attached a couple letters to the packets that you have on the back there. One letter is from Mark Beam, the manager of Odell Sanitary District in Hood River.
Mr. Chair, do you have the packet?
Yeah, we haven't got them yet.
Well, yes, Burton took them from you but didn't bother to pass them on, so
I'll report that back to the Special Districts Association.
I think that would be good.
Yeah. I would make that motion.
Mark talks about problems in trying to locate businesses such as a window plant and old mill conversion in Hood River County. And then there's also a letter from the Island City Area Sanitary District where they talk about an industrial park and problems with contamination of the Grand Ronde River, similar to what Shirley was talking about there.
Okay.
We are here today to talk about technology change, and I think that's important. It's a technology option that will help our economic development efforts and will protect the health of our people. Allow me to explain. According to the Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development Executive Director, Gordon Safley, the best thing we can do to create jobs is to make it less expensive for new and existing businesses to grow. Oftentimes, this translates into businesses allowing them to expand or to move into underutilized existing facilities outside cities. Our economic development folks talk about allowing businesses to grow until they are right size and can afford better space inside cities or until the city is ready to annex them. However, current state law and administrative rules are making this very difficult, in some cases impossible. Allow me to discuss two businesses outside urban growth boundaries that needed sewer. The first was allowed to have sewer service, and they have stayed in Oregon, and in fact have grown from 75 to 400 family wage jobs. The second started as a three-person operation 5 years ago and has grown to 12. All are family wage jobs. Their plan is to add 11 more people this year and to add 15 in the future, a total of 38 jobs, but they need sanitary sewer service. My first example is Ericsson Air Crane. In 1991, the owner was finalizing a deal to purchase Sikorsky helicopters from Connecticut and was making a decision where to expand. They were spending about $50,000 a year in septic tank, pumping out their septic tanks, and so this providing sewer service was a major obstacle. We were able to connect them, and therefore we have 400 jobs now in our community, and Connecticut lost 150 jobs. Our success in keeping them in Southern Oregon also has additional advantage of keeping their helicopters available to help with forest fires. My second example is Eden Valley Orchard, where a third-generation orchardist family is developing a business which will showcase farming. They are converting a historic Voorhees mansion into a meeting center and a wine-tasting destination, ideally situated between Ashland Shakespeare Festival and Jacksonville's Britt Gardens. It will provide a wonderful tourist spot where thousands can learn the history of our orchards in Southern Oregon. Their idea are already helping to promote Rising Sun Farms, another agritourist business outside the UGB that was able to grow because we were able to provide sewer service to them under the old regulations, and several other farm businesses. Ideas such as wine and farm tours where visitors take trolley rides between several farm businesses, one of the things that Eden Valley Orchards is working on. However, even though we have existing sanitary sewer line running along the front of the Eden Valley Orchard, within 100 feet of the house, they cannot connect, and it's difficult to grow. The county says they can have a winery, wine tasting, a demonstration vineyard, and pear orchard, community college classes, and even a restaurant, but they cannot connect to sewer. They're even required to have curb stops and bike racks by county ordinances for their potential 100,000 customer visitors a year. However, visitors may have to use porta potties. As the owner told me, why do we encourage agritourism? Why do we allow businesses to develop along existing roadways if we're not going to allow them to have the services they need to grow and to create jobs?
Mr. Root, what I'm going to do is ask you if you can summarize the rest of your testimony. Because I think we're definitely seeing some of the issues that you're bringing forward.
Yes. All right. Thank you. I'll skip. Right now, state law allows businesses and homes outside urban growth boundaries to be served by electricity, natural gas, solid waste, cable TV, high-speed fiber optics, newspapers, fire, police, vector control, libraries, mass transit, park and rec, and every other service there is. The only issue is whether or not the utilities, policies, and financing allow construction. But when it comes to sanitary sewer, I would argue the most important, as far as protecting health of our citizens and the quality of groundwater is concerned, sanitary sewer service cannot be provided. I'll be happy to skip for this, and I'd like to respond a little to a couple of the questions if I.
I appreciate you bringing up the issue about the sanitary sewer and the health of the groundwater, because that was a question I was going to ask, but you've already answered it. So,
okay.
And that is, I mean, when you have septic tank versus a sewer system, the sewer system obviously is going to be a much healthier alternative, both for the water system as well as groundwater, as well as the ground itself. Am I correct in that?
Very much so, yes.
Can I make a comment to that? Recently, or several years ago, we put a sewer line in along a main road, high or school district and so forth, and we all of a sudden got complaints that all the people's wells were going dry. So that gives you an idea of what a sewer can do, and people don't check their water like they should. Consequently, it's just an open department for the problem.
People's wells were going dry, so that means what they were drinking was...
Yeah.
It was filtered, but anyway, Representative Worth and then Representative Mabry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The letter that you were referencing or that you read encouraged the expansion of businesses located outside of a city by easing the development restrictions, existing development restrictions. Now, in my mind, allowing a business to expand that's located outside of a city but within the UGB is a huge difference than allowing a business to expand that's located outside of a current UGB. When within the UGB, it's eventually slated for development. Therefore, that's one thing. But I mean, I'm not clear. I thought we were talking about extending sewer only to a few existing homes. So, but now you're talking about potentially using this bill for allowing expansion of existing businesses that are outside the UGB.
Yes, that's right. To allow for job creation, and I guess I can take Burton's cop out here that I'm not a technician on planning, on zoning. If the county allows for development to occur, then it's, as the chairman said, it's a technology option to provide sanitary sewer as opposed to septic systems.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And as far as I'm aware, that you know there is an allowance within the current land use laws for health hazard annexation. So if there is any kind of problem with sewers, that the city can, without voter approval, even in cities that have a voter annexation requirement, extend services out there because of health hazard reasons. So I think that that would address what you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I didn't finish my testimony here, but there are instances where it's very, very difficult and expensive. The orchard that I was referring to has already spent $150,000 on land use considerations, and so it's very difficult. There was a fire district that also was 100 feet from one of our line and was able to go through that exceptions process, but it was very onerous on them. And that's why I'm saying, why sewer when all other services can be provided? Why is sewer separated out?
That's a very good question. Follow up.
Well, as far as I understand, we couldn't run streets out there. I mean, that's extension of services. I mean, when we talk about infrastructure, that we would need to go through the exceptions process to run, city standard streets out to a business outside the UGB.
I'm not an expert on streets.
Let me bring this back around, if I may, to the bill itself, because I think that I don't want us to get lost in some of the other things here. The bill is actually pretty narrow from a standpoint of what it's going to allow, and I appreciate what you're saying about other services. And I mean, a county road in some respects is going to be an extension of a road, and so to say that we don't have any infrastructure outside the urban growth boundary is not necessarily going to be exactly correct. But the bill is very narrow from the standpoint of it's not going to allow for changing of the zoning. It doesn't allow for, because of the extension of the sanitary sewer service being there, allow for expansion of the urban growth boundary. But my understanding is that by the way that the bill is written, is that for people who, if a the sanitary sewer basically runs in front of their property, allow them to go ahead and hook up as opposed to not being able to hook up, so that the overall protection that that may afford to our environmental considerations ought to be looked at.
But Mr. Chair, if I may, Mr. Weiss stated that existing sewer lines are often not even anywhere near where the lots that need connecting are located, and that's my concern.
Okay, valid concern. Representative Mabry, you had a...
I just want a brief comment. They mentioned in their testimony the Odell Sanitary District, which is in Hood River County. Jerry Routson, who was a county commissioner there for, I don't know, either 40 years or 140 years, I'm not sure, called me at home last night and made it abundantly clear that even though he's not in my district, I didn't have any choice but to support this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Root, I asked Burton Weiss as to number of properties that are affected. I wonder if you could break that out for us as to number of properties. And it sounds to me that we're looking at a couple of different things for on the end for Bear Creek Valley. And that would be number of homes that are existing, ready to go, number of businesses, as well as undeveloped property that finds itself adjacent to or close enough that would be covered by this bill, in your opinion?
Okay. I'm not sure that I can give you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I'm not sure I can give you a complete answer to that.
Why don't you give me your best shot?
Okay. First, Shirley was mentioning that in her district there's about half a dozen existing, maybe 10, 12.
I've got her. Okay. It's really for the Bear Creek Valley
location. Yes. And we were formed prior to much legislation prior to 1970, and are the drainage as the drainage basin in the area. I guess the best way I can answer it is that people do come into us that have been in our district for all of the years of our existence. I would say we get maybe a dozen a year that would come in and ask about this, but I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers. There are a lot of lots, and if somehow practical considerations would never allow us to go far, but there are a lot of lots in that large area. But practical considerations would limit it quite drastically.
Okay. Any other questions for... I see Burton back there kind of antsy, and why don't we go ahead and...
Mr. Chair, I know you're in a hurry, and I promise not to prolong this. I want to emphasize, Burton Weiss for Special Districts, two things. I want to emphasize this bill does not allow zone changes or development changes as a result of the sewer. It works exactly like water currently works. Water can be inside or outside an urban growth boundary, but the existence of water cannot be used as a factor for density and those kinds of things outside of UGB. This bill very specifically says if you're inside the district but outside the UGB, you can do what you're allowed to do today. You can't exceed that. The only difference is you can hook up to the sewer. If I may, Chair Crummell, too, and Representative Worth, I think good question about the extension of services. The fact is only sewer is restricted from those services that you can provide inside or outside the UGB. You can extend water anywhere you want in Oregon. In fact, there's 3,500 water systems in Oregon that are outside urban growth boundaries. So you can, it's only sewer. And the reason for that is a historical one. Way back in 20 years ago, the concern was if you extended sewer outside of UGBs, you'd take growth with you. And that would be de facto the decision about where the UGB would go. What has happened since then is we have 20 years of comprehensive plans. Every square foot is zoned. Every square foot of the state has land use restrictions on it. All this bill does is very narrowly try to deal with the issue of people who found themselves within districts but can't get the service that they're paying for within the district. It's an extremely narrow bill in that regard. And that's why we put all that, your original question, that's why we put all that language about not changing zoning, not, you know, not upsetting the urban growth issue. Thank you.
Clarification, Representative Worth.
Mr. So you're saying that we could run a standard city standard street curb and gutter out beyond the urban growth boundary right now?
The county, which would control that, has a right to set the county road standards, and they can build the road system. There's nothing that says you can't build a collector or an arterial if it's needed outside of UGB. It happens all the time. There's fairly large unincorporated communities and other communities outside the UGB that have large area. The Green District, White City, and well, that's in boundary now.
But I'm saying a city standard because sewers, I mean, wells are along in the county with the county roads. I'm talking about a city sewer service, which would then go along with your curb and gutter, your city standard street. So I think we're talking about, you can run your county streets out there, but then you're talking about, you know, sewer land or well land. You're not talking about city sewers.
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that. The bottom line I can tell you is this bill does nothing to affect current zoning, current uses, and all those other services. All it does is add sewer to the thing if you're within an existing sewer district, not expanding in the future. The bill prohibits that. But if you're in the existing sewer service, it'll let you have sewer just like you're allowed to have water and everything else right now. It's the best way I can answer that. I'm sorry. Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You may want to bring it back on Thursday to see where we go.
Yeah, it would appear that it does. Okay. Okay, thank you very much for the discussion. I do appreciate it. At this point, it appears that the bill may have a constitutional issue, and so I'm going to hold off on doing anything with this and possibly on Thursday. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2961. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3060. And Dave, you and Michelle want to come on up? And okay, you go call Michelle and we'll move on to something else then. I'm going to recess the work session on House Bill 3060. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3072. Patrick, you want to give us a little lowdown on this bill, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3072, we heard on March 25th. The bill authorizes state boards and commissions to issue occupational or professional licenses to require licensees to demonstrate and maintain tax compliance as a condition of issuance or renewal of those said licenses. It allows the Department of Revenue to disclose tax information to agencies, boards, and commissions that require tax compliance. We have in front of us the Dash 1 amendments to the bill. Those amendments... legislative fiscal indicates they have minimal fiscal impact and there's no revenue impact to those amendments. And Representative Butler will be attending shortly.
Should we recess and come back to 60?
Yes, I'm going to recess the... I'm going to recess the public hearing or the work session on 3072. I'm going to reopen the work session on 3060. Dave, you and Michelle want to come up, please?
Paul kicks his office. Come on, he finds him and get his ass down here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3060. This bill was originally scheduled about a month ago. At that time, Ms. Dicer and I were the only people who testified on the bill. We indicated to the chair that we thought we could make amendments that would satisfy both the League of Oregon Cities and us. Subsequent to that, we had a meeting. We agreed to amendments, got a note from the chair, and those amendments are what appear in front of you as the Dash 1 amendments. This bill deals with local improvement districts and essentially makes amendments to ORS 223.415 and 223.410 to make it clear that in the situation where a local government creates a local improvement district and then changes that local improvement district as a result of either a judgment of a court or a finding by the local government that there's some type of defect with the formation of the district, this bill makes it clear that they, in those situations where they're changing the district, they can only change the spread of the assessment, the apportionment of the assessment, the amount that each landowner, the amount of the total assessment that each particular person in the district is going to pay. They can only change that if they demonstrate, based on the facts that are available to everybody at the time that the district is formed, that adopting a different plan, adopting a different spread of the assessments is essential to secure an equitable assessment. That's the language that applies currently in statute to when a local government declares their second process a reassessment. That same language doesn't apply when the local government declares that second process a new estimated or final assessment. This is a procedural fix that's designed to clarify that. And like I say, Ms. Dyster and I met on this, and I believe are in agreement on the amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't dispute anything that Mr. Honeycutt has said. For the record, I'm Michelle Dyster with the League of Oregon Cities, and I think this is going forward basis. This just adds a little bit of clarity to the local improvement district statute, which is by its nature a bit convoluted and confusing. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
Just for the record, the dash one basically replaces the current bill and it's substituted in. It's not, I guess you could say, somewhat a gut and stuff, but it still deals with the same subject and just been rewritten.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, yeah, the dash ones are a gut and stuff, but they do. It addresses the same problem, uses some different wording, and clarifies.
Okay. Are there any other questions for... either Michelle or... Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
Move the dash ones into House Bill 3060.
Representative Przanski... Representative?
You're there.
Representative Przanski moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3060. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3060 as amended at the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 3060 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Ginny, you want to go ahead and call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3060, as amended, receiving the constitutional majority, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a volunteer to carry this?
Me.
Representative Nelson, you want to carry it, huh? Okay. With that, then, I will close the work session on House Bill 3060. Thank you. I'm going to now go back to the work session on House Bill 3072 and open that. Representative Butler, come on up. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Mike, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60. On 3072, you should have dash one amendment.
Okay, and let's see. So that might be in the pile that we received. Oh, there they are.
Okay.
Yes, sir. We do have those.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in meeting with representatives from some of the licensing, including Mr. Bob Russell from the representing the trucking industry, Martin Taylor, some of the nurses, and some of the other folks that were concerned about professional licensure, they were concerned that there were a couple of words that they have to demonstrate compliance, and and that's on line six. What we've done there is we've just that they will attest to their compliance when they file for their licenses, for their privileged licenses, and down on 11 and 12, striking the words on 11 and 12 following the word licensee, so they will renew the license if the licensee, and then inserting has been subject to 100% penalty under the Oregon Revised Statutes with respect to personal income taxes of the licensee. We felt like that this was basically leaving them so that if their license could become a question if they continued to willfully and I think the terms that are used in the Department of Revenue are that they willfully and continuously neglect their responsibilities relative to their income tax responsibilities to the state of Oregon. And with that, Mr. Chair, I've got a sign-off by at least Mr. Russell representing those folks, and we all agreed in our previous work together on this, that this, if we would put this language in, that would soften it up for those folks who desired to go ahead with the, that they wouldn't object to the language in the bill. And I'm just coming from the General Government Ways and Means, where Director Harchenko has given us our first round of information. There's a couple of old licensing boards in the state of Oregon which have information that we could use, that we could actually tie up. And we found that in the first run of 23,000 in-state addressed licenses for the one particular licensing board, about 15% had not filed income tax returns. It doesn't mean that they're standing in line to lose their license under this bill. It means that the Department of Revenue will send them a letter and ask them if they should have filed, what number they may have filed under. And they may have no reason to file, but they're continuing to buy a privilege license, which leaves it somewhat suspect. But the comment of the director from the Department of Revenue was, I certainly hope that we have the continued ability to do what this particular bill does, and that's why I thought I'd better come down and make sure that these dash ones were appended so we could continue to move the bill, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Butler. Are there any questions, Representative Krasanski?
Mr. Chair, thanks. Tom, I appreciate the dash ones. My questions really are going to be for the second part of the bill under lines 13 and continuing. When reading this last night, I came to my attention that we're basically, it looks like, under lines 13 through 17, going to give the Department of Revenue the authority to disclose to any agency, board, or commission that requires this tax compliance, basically any information that the department requires as necessary to assist them in verifying the compliance. My concern is confidentiality for these individual taxpayers. I know that was one of your goals, was to maintain that, and I'm just concerned if the wording here isn't too broad as to not having sideboards to make certain that they only give what's necessary for the compliance as compared to maybe more sensitive personal information.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are sensitive to that, and in working with Director Harchenko, any information which is not required, which would be any personal information about them other than just the filing, the actual filing itself of a return itself, is subject to a Class C felony, which is 5 years or $100,000. And she assures me that these sideboards are sufficient to make sure that if anyone tries or anyone does in fact divulge information beyond that, that it is a felony. So she felt that this was a sideboard, and the agent or the folks that we met with, the licensing folks, felt like that this was permissive enough that it doesn't violate, and it does continue to protect the confidential information which is not necessary other than just the fact that filings are occurring in order for the permissive licenses or the licenses themselves is still protected by Oregon statute.
Mr. Chair, can I just
follow up? Yes.
Tom, would you be a comment? To me, if all we're wanting them to do is say, yes, this person has complied or they have filed, can't we just limit that to what information is actually disclosed, is that they have a filing from this individual and they're in compliance with filing, as compared to, it just seems so broad when you say any information the department considers necessary to assist them. And to me, what I understand is what we're just saying, have the person filed or have they not? If they have filed, so be it. If they haven't, then that could be considered within being noncompliant for that agency.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krasanski, I appreciate your concern. The department may disclose to the state agency or commission that requires the tax compliance as a condition of issuance of the renewal of the license any information the department considers necessary to assist the state agency. Again, the confidential information continues to be protected by Class C felony statutes. What we were concerned about here was being able to track not just the fact that they had filed, what years they had filed, and where their address was. And this is information which may be necessary in order to track the individual that is applying, and that's information which would which may be necessary. It's not necessarily information which is needed to be known by anyone other than the agency which is authorizing the privilege permit. So addresses could be exchanged, and years of filing could be exchanged, but no confidential information is divulged under this. This is the language which Director Harchenko agreed to.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Avakian.
Thank you. I'm assuming the intent of this is to get people to pay their taxes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, this is to encourage tax compliance. We've got right now of the total population, about it's nearly 90% are voluntarily compliant with all of the tax laws. But yes, that's what this is about, is to make sure that those folks that are obtaining privileged licenses in the state of Oregon are on our income tax rolls as well.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I'm not understanding what's inadequate about our existing law, since we have the ability right now to levy penalties, attach property, garnish wages, and collect taxes that are delinquent, and why there's an additional method that's necessary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, that's an excellent question. What we have here is basically a system which will share information between the Department of Revenue, which the Department of Revenue presently doesn't have the capacity to reach out and share because of the fact that folks presently, when they have been applying for licenses, do not have to, number one, show any degree of compliance with the income tax, nor answer any questions that they are complying with income taxes, nor do they have to divulge to their licensing agency any way that the licensing agency can confirm that they are in compliance with the income tax requirements of the state of Oregon. So what this does is this says, if you are going to procure that higher level of licensing, then we want you to attest to your licensing board that you are in compliance with the tax statutes. It then gives the Department of Revenue the ability to go ahead and cooperate with the licensing agency to say, yes, there has been a return filed for 2000, 2001, and 2002, and yes, the address is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions for Representative Butler? Representative, thank you. After we finish the work session on this one, I'm planning to go to 3073. Is that your one that you wanted to stay
yes,
for?
Yes, 3073 is mine, and I believe that there may be someone here to speak on behalf of it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Is
there, Bob, did you want to say anything about 3072? No. Great. We are in a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
Let's see. I guess we first need to move the dash once in House Bill 3072. Excuse me.
Thank you. Representative Przanski moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3072. Is there any discussion? Are there any? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Przanski?
Mr. Chair, I'd now move House Bill 3072 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 3072 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any? Representative Avakian, yes.
I suppose I've got concerns, one, about the necessity of this, because I think the state has got the ability to collect the taxes that are delinquent if it needs, but above and beyond that, I don't see a reasonable connection between a licensing body which has a duty to ensure consumer protection for folks, and that's the whole purpose of licensing, and the separate agency of this state that is to collect our taxes, and why one would be used with the other to leverage the payment of taxes. I don't see the reasonable connection between the two. And I hate to put our licensing bodies in the position of being the tax police, which this really does. I do applaud the efforts by the representative to make sure that we get all the revenue that this state is due. Lord knows we need it. But I'm just not convinced that this is the appropriate use of a licensing body in this state.
Good.
Given such, I don't know that I could support the bill.
Okay. Okay. So noted. Thank you. Representative Kitt.
Mr. Chair, I think that Representative Avakian brings up some good points. I will be supporting this bill in committee, but we'll be addressing those concerns with him at a later date. Or goes to the floor. So I'll be voting yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I commend our most respected Representative Butler for bringing this to our attention, and I appreciate that he seems to always have a solution and a good one when we need it.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion? I think I would just point out, and being a person that this is going to affect from a standpoint and with two licensing boards in the state, I don't have a problem attesting to the licensing board that I'm compliant with my taxes. I have a bigger problem with giving the licensing board my Social Security number than I do telling them that I'm whether or not I'm compliant with our state tax laws. So I'll support the bill as well. I think that Representative Butler has brought a reasonable bill to us, and I appreciate what Representative Avakian is addressing. And so anyway, if there's not any other discussion, Gina, call the roll, please.
No.
Aye.
Representative
Mason?
Aye.
Representative
Johnson?
Aye.
Representative
Warren?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3072 is amended, receiving the constitutional majority is declared passed. And to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Butler, would you like to carry that? Representative Butler, with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3072. And I'm going to let me go ahead and open a work session for informational purposes at this point on House Bill 3073. And Representative Butler, did you want to address something with anything with that as far as bringing us up to date on any amendments that might be pending and that sort of thing, please?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Tom Butler from House District 60 again. I don't have any amendments to 3073. 3073 was the bill which asked the governor annually to give us information relative to all of those folks who are working or contracting with the state of Oregon. I understand that there is a fiscal, and I would encourage you to go ahead and pass the bill from your committees here and move it to the Ways and Means process where we can deal with the fiscal relating to the concerns that this information may have to be reformatted, and we'll just need to take a look because we will have actually an information technology subcommittee taking a look at all of the formatting and information management systems in the state. And what actually happens is that most of the information already exists for all of the employees. It's a matter of just reformatting it for all of the employees, but it does not presently exist for each of the contractors. The contractors only receive a 1099 from the state of Oregon and not a 1099 which identifies what type of activity they're in which they're engaged. And so we will have to reformat and for that, and there is a small fiscal, so I would encourage your I vote on this particular bill and move it to Ways and Means.
Okay. And is there a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
There was not.
There was not. Okay. But that's okay. We can still move it to Ways and Means. So you would like us to go into work session for the purposes of, I mean, we're already in work session, but you would like us to go ahead and move the bill over to Ways and Means so that they can examine the, so the question for us is whether or not it's a policy that that we want to, address.
Yes,
am I understanding?
Chair, and the fiscal is around for this current biennium beginning this next year to to migrate the system so that it would do what it is that we need information on would be under $150,000, is my understanding, with I don't know how many FTE is generated, but it's a matter of moving it to the information technology sub and Ways and Means, where they can discuss all of the reformatting, because most all of the reports have to be reformatted on an annual year on an annual basis. But I would say this, that with regard to contracting, because the contracting presently doesn't have a field, an array, which really demonstrates why people are contracting with the state presently at the Department of Administrative Services, even though that information may be known, we don't have a reporting mechanism to do that. So I appreciate the fact that there is a small fiscal on it.
Okay. Thank you. Cindy, did you have anything you wanted to add on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Cindy Becker, Department of Administrative Services. Representative Butler is correct. We don't have this information in any cohesive format. There's lots of it's out there, but even though we could easily provide information on all of the employees, but when you're going to getting into job descriptions and getting into other information, that we don't have that automated anywhere. So to have a brief description, you're probably looking, you know, for the 40,000 employees, you're going to have, I'm hoping you don't want that in paper, because you'll have about a mountain of information when you add the job descriptions, but I'm sure Representative Butler doesn't want that on paper. The other one, which is more difficult to put together, although something we can do, is the contract information. And DAS does not have all of that. Agencies, for example, don't have to go through DAS for contracts that are under $75,000. And also, they don't have to bid out contracts that are under $5,000. And a lot of the personal service contracts that are with individuals versus corporations are in those smaller numbers. And we don't collect that information at DAS. So the agencies do, which is a question of getting that information, collecting it, automating it, and that's really where your initial cost of $149,000, would really be getting our arms around all of that, because a lot of that contract information resides at the agency level and not at DAS. Happy to answer any other questions. It's all doable, but it just isn't something that we have now and would have to build.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Cindy? Representative Mabry.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I need to be excused for a few moments to meet with a constituent, but I'd just like to make a comment, if I may. I would support getting this information out of respect for Representative Butler, who I respect a great deal. However, my concern is requiring something that is of no true value in raw form. And I guess I would use an example of the 350 or so Oregon State police troopers that we have in the state, which are just 350 of 40 or 50,000 employees. You can get a list in their job description and what they earn and all those things. But once you've got that information, it doesn't tell you, for example, in my district, whether they're patrolling between Arlington and Cascade Locks or Hood River and the Dalles. They can't tell you from that information whether they're patrolling Highway 84, Highway 35, Highway 30, Highway 26, Highway 218, Highway 197, or Highway 97, and how far they go. They can't tell from that raw data whether they're sleeping in Fulton Canyon half of their shift or really out working. They can't tell any of those things. It's just raw data. So to make that data worthwhile, you have to hire someone like a Tom Butler who can work through that. And to do that, and then because there's so many, you have to have a staff of thousands to make it worthwhile. And it seems to me we're adding to the bureaucracy instead of doing what the goal is. And I don't know the answer. I certainly think this information ought to be available to anybody that needs it, but I just hate to see us start a brand new bureaucracy out of those things. With that, if I may be excused for a few minutes.
Can you hang tight for just a minute or so?
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I thought I coached Representative Mabry better, but I'll work on it. I tried to make an administrator of him instead of a judge. You know, having dug for basic information from this state and spent good time over in DAS, I just want to compliment DAS because, you know, what I have found out is that if you go over there, you can make it happen and get the information. But nobody that I know of knows how many are employed in our state, what the category of salaries are, how many of those are in overhead, how many aren't, what their performance criteria is, and having spent the greatest portion of my life administering worldwide bases, I think it's imperative you've got a payroll to revenue in business ratio that you worry about consistently in state government. Payroll to revenue has been a ratio that none of us have even been able to get an answer to. So I think it's great. Go for it. And I can show you what to do with these numbers.
Well, the greatest portion of your life can only be 5 or 10 years.
Well, you're right.
Okay, I'm going to, Representative Worth, you had a comment or a question?
I guess I remember during the special sessions pretty easily and clearly eliminating positions of public employees and how much that saved the state, and that was pretty readily available, unfortunately. And it was pretty drastic. But I'm concerned, I guess I have a question about the personnel that are employed by the state through contracts. So did I hear you say that we have that information readily available, just not broken down into the specifics?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, it's available. I don't know that I'd call it readily available. It's all at the agencies. Most of that's at the agencies, particularly when you're getting into individuals versus corporations. We don't house that information, and we don't have it on any kind of a database, so we would have to ask all of the agencies to go into their contracts and determine which of these folks are independent contractors versus corporations. Then once they determine that, they would have to provide us with the individual contractual information, which we could do, but it's a process that we haven't done in the past, and it would just take some resources to make that happen, but it's not readily available.
But we do, I guess, quick follow-up. We do know what we're spending, correct?
Representative Kremel and Representative Worth, yes, we do have the information on the contracts, but, you know, when we do individual contracts, particularly those under $75,000, there's a variety of costs in those contracts, and a portion of those contracts are going to be around individual personal services, but there may be other things that they're acquiring, hardware, software, various other things for contracts. We have to split those costs out. So we can tell you how much we're spending on personal service contracts, how much of that is going to individuals is another layer that we have to go into.
Okay. Thank you.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just want to add a remark that an actual factual situation that happened during this very year when we were determining whether we should go along with the cuts from the agencies in the last special session, we were very disturbed that we could not find where the individuals were being cut. And in fact, it was not until during this session that Representative Greg Smith came to me and showed me a cut in Health and Human Services where all the cuts had been made at the local level, and one physical therapist cut at the state level. So I'm just saying there's really good use of this information, and I look forward to having it.
Okay. With that, Representative Przanski?
Yeah. On the contractors, I understand, Cindy, at this point we'd have to actually ask each of the agencies to compile that information. And have you done any speculating, guesstimating as to the cost for those agencies to comply with the request coming from DAS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, we haven't done that. It's really going to be dependent on how well or how automated each of the agencies currently have their contracts. In some of the smaller agencies, I don't know how automated they are, so they may actually have to read through some of the contracts. I know some of the larger ones are in the process of automating it. But again, what they have typically would be the amount of the contract and the purpose of the contract and the length of the contract. They would not, I suspect, have information that gets into the detail of the contract.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Based on this information that we've heard from DAS, as well as some of the concerns that Representative Mabry's had. I'm not going to be able to support the bill at this point because I'm trying to figure out what are we trying to accomplish, how are we going to actually accomplish it. It seems to me that the only way that we're going to make any heads and tails of it once you get whatever the volume of information that we are going to get, and it appears that for state employees we're looking at 40 to 50,000 entries, how many more contracts, consultants that we have from large or small businesses, who knows. And then once we get it, I'm trying to figure out what do we do with it when it comes on our desk. I mean, I get enough material delivered to my desk in my office that, you know, there's only so many bookshelves that you can fill up. And I'm trying to figure out how are we going to actually make use of that information without having some type of super audit capacity. And unless this legislature is planning on, as Representative Mabry says, open up a new bureaucratic agency to actually go through the material, I know my staff isn't going to have time to go through it. And even if they did go through it, what are they going to get? They're going to get the name of somebody, their address, what position they hold, and the amount of money they're getting paid. It's not going to tell us anything about whether they're performing a job to the level that we need to, whether that job's necessary to complete the work of the agency. It seems to me that our goal here is to micromanage agencies to the point of, I don't know to what point, but it sure in the heck isn't seeing that it's going to give us any quality information to make any policy decisions as compared to management decisions, which, if I remember correctly, our body is to make policy, not to manage. That's why we have an executive branch.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Would you support moving it to Ways and Means with no recommendation?
No. I don't see the
You don't see the value in the bill at all?
I don't see it. I mean, okay. Based on what we had from the previous test hearing, is we're going to get the name, the job title, the description, the agency, and how much they're paid. Those five entries is just going to give us a list of how many people are either employees or somehow under contract with the state or an agency or subsidiary of the state. And, I mean, it doesn't go through the audit process unless we're going to take each of those divisions within each of the agencies, look at what they're delegated for their tasks, and whether or not we have the staffing adequate or overstaffed. I just don't see it. There's a volume of stuff, be it on a disk, be it on hard copy. So it just sits and accumulates dust, or we start making shots at agencies saying, this agency has a budget of this amount with these number of employees. But, you know, that is the anti-government perspective of going after individuals without having any basis to whether the agency is performing the job that we have delegated them to do as a policy.
Okay.
So, no, I would not be comfortable supporting. I mean, why prolong it? I mean, I just haven't seen the merits of it. Representative Butler has other ways of demonstrating how this is actually going to be used and will complement our work. It'll be great. I just haven't seen it or heard it.
Okay. Okay. That's fine. Are there any other comments or questions for Cindy? With that, then, thanks, Cindy. I think what I'll do is I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3703, and then we will give Representative Butler a chance to talk to the committee members and clarify any concerns that they may have.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I've got two more things, Representative, that I'd like to do if I may. There, and hopefully they'll be very quick.
Okay.
You're the boss. Okay, thank you. One is I would like to open a work session on House Bill 3206, and we have some amendments for this. And Patrick, can you fill me in on that, please? 3206.
Sure, Representative Mr. Chair. House Bill 3206, which we heard on April 1st, directs State Fire Marshal to adopt a statewide urban confined space and structural collapse response plan.
Oh, wait. No,
I'm not sure.
I just
have any chance.
adopt an old copy?
Okay.
I just want to make sure.
Yeah, this bill is.
Okay.
The bill directs state fire marshal to adopt a statewide urban confined space and structure collapse plan and involves Oregon Emergency Management. We heard this bill, like I said, on April 1st. We have before us dash one and dash two amendments, and Bob Garrison is here, and we'll be able to talk to those amendments.
Okay. Bob, you want to just real quickly tell us about the amendments and everything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bob Garrison, State Fire Marshal. As we indicated in our testimony previously, there were some amendments requested on this bill, one of them at the request of the Sheriff's Association. They recognized the need for the sheriffs and counties to be somewhat more involved than the original language had indicated, and so they had asked that county sheriff be inserted in a couple of instances where it would verify their authority to secure the site, and in what other instance where it would assure that information would be shared with them as well as with police chiefs. So that's the first half of the dash one. The second half has to do with liability of the responders when they move out of their jurisdictions or out of their fire districts to provide assistance. This is standardized language that comes out of a number of other statutes. Legislative Council had drafted the original language and then had arrived at a concern about what they had drafted and had asked for the opportunity to amend that language, and that's the second half. Their section 6 in the dash 1 is the new language on liability from Legislative Council. There was also a dash 2 that was written up, but we're going to ask that that not be put forth at this time. Okay. We'll stay with the dash one.
So the dash one is what is what you prefer,
Mr. Chair.
That's
correct,
and that's agreeable to all of the parties concerned.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. With that, then, Representative Brzezinski, would you like to do the honors,
Mr. Chair? I'm dash ones into House Bill 3206.
Thank you, Representative Brzezinski. Moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3206. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Brzezinski?
Now move the dash twos into 3206.
What they were saying was that they didn't want to do anything with the dash twos.
Excuse me, I will withdraw that motion and instead amend that motion to say I now move House Bill 3206 as amended with the dash ones to the floor of the pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 3206 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Gina, you want to call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Excuse. Aye. House Bill 3206, receiving the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Kitts, would you carry that bill, please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Representative Kitts will be the carrier of the work session on House Bill 3206. I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2961. And let's see, just a second, I got to find the bill here. I understand Representative Brzezinski has some concerns about this, and what I would like to do is get this bill moving on through the process. It does not have a subsequent referral, though. Is that correct, Patrick?
Mr. Chair, the bill does not have a subsequent referral. We have not, as yet, received a fiscal statement from Legislative Fiscal Office on the bill.
We're not anticipating seeing any kind of a fiscal on it. Is that correct?
I cannot speak to that. It was not Legislative Fiscal Office was not able to give me their assessment of that. But presumably, it would not be sufficient to warrant referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
If we don't have a fiscal, isn't our procedure or process requires that we have a fiscal before we actually move the bill?
If there's a question about it, yes, there generally is a request that we have fiscal before we move the bill, although that doesn't necessarily preclude us from being able to
move the bill forward. I understand, Representative, you have some concerns about the bill, and
I do.
In terms of
policy,
do you want to put those on the record, or
Mr. Chair, I'm going to oppose the bill as it's currently has been brought forward. Questions were not able to be answered. This is the first time supposed to have a hearing on this bill, and I find the information that we see lacking as to what is the full impact. It does, in fact, have the desire to change certain goals that are within our planning process, and quite interesting, as Representative Worth pointed out, where we were first hearing about a bill that was going to take care of a few families, we're now looking at potential considerable development and expansion outside of EGBs. For those reasons, I think that we're pushing something very quickly in haste that's going to have, I believe, potential very significant unintended consequences or circumstances that have not been debated or discussed at this level. And for that, I'm not ready to move forward.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Based on hearing from my CBS, that's my big ticket voice system, I'm going to move House Bill 2961 to the House floor with the recommended due pass.
Okay. Representative Nelson moves House Bill 2161 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
What did I say?
No, you said it correct. 29, not 2161.
Oh, I'm sorry. 2961 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We almost sent the wrong bill. We don't even
know what that one is.
I don't know. thank you, Representative, for the motion. Is there any further discussion about the bill? Representative Worth.
I just want to put on the thing, Mr. Chair, put on the record that I'll be putting in opposition to this bill for the reasons reiterated by Representative Przanski, and as well as.
Now wait a minute. He was reiterating what you were reiterating, and so now you're reiterating what he was reiterating.
Reiteration, right?
Oh, okay.
There's an exceptions process.
Reiteration.
There's an exceptions process already outlined in the state land use system, and this should go through that process. And the whole idea of a UGB is to keep growth inside of it. So I think this is just a drastic change from the current land use system, and a lot of unintended purposes.
Okay. Thank you. Your comments are noted. Representative Mabry.
Well, I just think that issue was covered very thoroughly by Mr. Weiss' testimony. This doesn't change land use policy, land use development standards, land use anything. It merely allows a potential groundwater contaminant through a septic system to hook onto a sanitary sewer and improve our environment. So, I think the concerns of expansion are greatly exaggerated.
Thank you. Okay, with that then, Jenny, you want to call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 No.
No.
Aye. House Bill 2961, having received a majority, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Mabry, would you like to carry this one?
Sure.
Okay, Representative Mabry will be the carrier. With that, I close the work session on 2961. Very quickly, committee, I just want to ask you, do you have we can actually start earlier than 5:30, although it's going to be pressing because I know Ag and Forestry is planning on meeting in this room until 5 o'clock. It would be necessary for staff to try to get the thing switched and everything. Do you want to start earlier than 5:30, or do you want to go ahead and keep it at 5:30?
Start earlier.
Earlier than better.
Are you aware that we have till 11:15 today?
Yes, I'm aware of that, but we have members that have some things that they needed to do, and we also had a posting issue, so we have to come back. Yes?
Could I just ask if you voted on 2148 and 2246 while I was
We did.
Incapacitated this morning?
We did.
Could I have permission to vote?
Can you... yeah...
Chair requests unanimous consent to suspend the rules and allow to reopen a work session on House Bill 2148 and the work session on 2246 so that to enable Representative Nelson to vote. Is there any objections?
Mr. Chair, may I also vote since we're...
Pardon me?
May I also vote since
we're... Since Representative Worth would like to vote also, is there any objections? Seeing none, Representative Worth, how do you, or Representative Nelson, how do you vote on 2148?
I vote yes, sir.
2148 is aye. 2246?
Aye.
And Representative Worth, how do you vote on 2148?
Aye.
And on 2246?
Aye.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the work session on those two bills. And let's try to go ahead and start at 5, and we'll try to get... okay? So with that, we are in recess until 5 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee, for...